Great to have you along today on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Well, some crazy weather here, isn't it? Across a good share of Wisconsin, high winds, tornadoes just the other day. Lots of rain and that rainy weather and those warm temperatures. I'm telling you, the mosquitoes are back in force. Before I could get the mosquito repellent on last night, I had a half a dozen bites on both legs. Larry Mueller here. Great to have you along today on the Ideas Network. We are going to visit with Phil Pelletieri today, our entomologist, UW Extension, just retired. Great to have him back, and certainly he's ready to answer your questions when you phone us at 1-800-642-1234, or shoot a question and photo to my Facebook page at The Larry Mueller Show, or post a question on email at talk@wpr.org. You know what? We may be having some trouble with email. Carl Christensen, it's possible that we may not be getting emails because the email system is down at the University of Wisconsin. So it's possible we may not, email may not work. Let's put it that way. So we'll see. Maybe it is working now. You can join in at 1-800-642-1234. Go to my Facebook page at The Larry Mueller Show. You can post a question or comment there. We can talk about mosquitoes. Before we get to that, let's talk about something a little more pleasant. Butterflies. Phil, you say butterflies seem to be up from last year. Why is that?
Well, last year was pathetic.
Yeah.
I don't remember things as light. And we equated some of it with the drought of the previous year and the end of the summer being stressful and then the monsoons and, a number of things going. But so last year, I think I saw my first monarch. It was well into June. This year, it was about the 10th of May. In fact, I've got an almost mature larvae on our butterfly weed at home, which I'm saving for my grandson.
And in
not just monarchs, but I've seen a number of red admirals. I've seen all three species of swallowtails in the southern part of the state. And so at least my early take on it, it is much improved over last year. And as I said, I think it's related to weather. And the interesting thing is you could say that the winter should have been tough on them, but most of them were in a life stage that was so well protected that they really weren't exposed to the kind of extremes that some of our above-ground plant material had to put up with.
So too soon to say whether it's a sign of a long-term improvement in the population?
Well, the monarch has been on the radar screen for the last 2 years in particular because of the combination of not good breeding in the United States and then the overwintering sites. We won't know where we're at until we get in the fall migration. But I will tell you, in past experiences, we've went in these historic lows, and all of a sudden, if you've got a good year, they come back very strong. So I'm hopeful that we'll be there.
And threats to butterflies? You mentioned a couple there, I think.
It always gets complicated because you've got, in Wisconsin, well over 150 species potentially. And so there's different scenarios. With the monarch, the overwintering sites and the ecology there has changed somewhat. There's a deforestation problem. Up here, the conversation is that wild milkweed is getting to be few and far between because of some of our agricultural practices. And then again, you put a weather condition where it's just not good. And it's kind of ganging up is the best way to put it. And so, as I said, I think we're all kind of hopeful that we do see a turnaround. And I know a lot of people are trying to help out and, growing milkweed in their backyard garden or butterfly weed or other plants in that family, which are, if they're not there, we've got no butterflies, or at least no monarchs. So
we need to do that if you're going to protect.
Well, it's just a good idea. As they said, it's a fun insect to sit and look. The caterpillars are just very, I think, very showy, aside from the adults, and they're fun to watch. Although I do tell people, because I often get the conversation where people saw some small caterpillars and all of a sudden they're gone. Well, there's things that eat them. And so what I tend to do, if I find a half-inch long caterpillar, if you're really trying to get a successful adult off, it's best to bring it in the house and babysit it, keep it away from the predators and the like, and then you'll have a higher success rate of getting adults.
And Kathy on Facebook wondered, how do you keep the Japanese beetles from devouring her roses?
There's
good
no
question.
Perfect, no perfect answer here. My first take on Japanese beetles this year is the numbers are going to be similar to last year. We've got some places in the state that they're just starting, and they would probably be quite bad in the areas like Madison, where we've had them for well over 10 years. I expect similar, which was low numbers last year. There are various chemicals that can be used, both organic and not, but the problem is that whatever one chooses, it only lasts for 4 or 5 days, and the beetles are feeding for 2 months, so it's a high maintenance issue. There are some systemic chemicals that you can pour in the ground that will protect the leaves, but the systemic chemicals do not protect the flowers, and so they still eat your flowers. Some people will literally put floating row cover and other things to try to keep them off. But the big frustration with Japanese beetle is that they don't breed in your yard. They come in from down the road. And so I can't even say, well, you do this in your yard, kill the grubs in your lawn, you won't have Japanese beetles. It's got nothing to do with it. So as I said, there really isn't a real easy answer except a very high maintenance. You know, some color roses are more attractive. The more the plant is in the shade, the less attractive it is. And the good news, if there is one to the Japanese beetle story, is again, in many areas, we find that over time, the numbers go down. And so what was seemed like just the plague from hell 10 years later can be just a few around. And, and as I said, that's something I've witnessed on the west side of Madison, especially in the last 5 or 6 years.
We have callers online. By the way, you can join in with your questions at 1-800-642-1234. Give us a call. And Michelle in Madison up next. Hi, Michelle. Thank you for calling.
Hi. Thanks for taking the call. I have a question about, I think they're called cluster flies, and it's something that we experienced last fall in just horrific numbers inside of a house, inside of our new house. And they're really docile. They don't seem to be after food. They die fast, so that's why I think that they're cluster flies. That's as much as I found out about them. But, you know, we vacuumed up 1,500 of them one day and then just quit counting. So how do you prevent them from getting it in the first place? Are they something that breeds in the lawn or?
No. So, you know, back in the day when I first started, people used to put chlordane on their lawn to kill earthworms. And the reasoning for that was that these are parasites of earthworms. But the reality is, like so many of these other insects, are coming from down the road. So it has nothing to do with your lawn. So my first concern is in a new house to get those kind of numbers, there is a structural weakness. And I don't know if it is a vent in the attic that's not screened properly or the soffit vents aren't designed right. But, you know, if this was an old farmhouse that would have lots of cracks and leaky areas, that's to be expected. But a new house should be tight enough that you may get an occasional one. And the reason I would prefer to get this weakness screened or caulked or whatever is that's the permanent solution. If you can't find the permanent solution, then the other option is to spray the sunny sides of the house about the first week of September. And I'm talking from the roof soffits, the overhangs all the way down. And they use a contact spray that has some residual. And so you can buy it yourself or you can contract for service with a pest control service. But the timing is everything because you basically kill them and repel them with this September treatment. Once they get up underneath the siding or in the attic or whatever, then there is no magic. And we know that the trigger for these is when the days are getting shorter. And as I said, so usually I would say around the first or second week of September. But I would go back to trying to figure. Now, sometimes it's obvious. All the cluster flies seem to be coming in the light fixtures in the bathroom. You know, they're coming down through, let's say, if you've got overhead lighting and the like. Then that suggests that the weakness is in the attic and they're working down from there. If it's everywhere in the house, it may be a little bit more ticklish. But as I said, a lot of the new houses have Tyvek and other wraps. So that would make it very difficult, even if they got under siding, for them to work in the house. You know, so as I said, to me, this kind of numbers suggest something, you know, caulking around windows, or as I said, I would particularly look at any kind of vent system I've got to make sure that there's a small enough screen that the flies can't push through that.
Okay, back to the drawing board. And so, just is there any such thing as doing the application too early of the pesticide?
Well, you know, in the far northern part of the state, I've had people tell me that in certain years they've seen cluster flies start to come in by the 20th of August. Down here, I wouldn't expect that. And you will see an ebb and flow by their populations depending on earthworm levels. If you've got droughty years, there's no earthworms. We see very few cluster flies typically. If you've got a very lush year and lots of worms, then look out, here they come in the fall.
And thanks very much for calling, Michelle. Appreciate it. I'm going to go to my Facebook page because we've got some great photos here of
a big and scary
over about 3 inches across.
Sure. So because of the banding in the legs, I can tell that this is what we would call a fishing spider. The genus is Dolomedes. But you can often see fishing spiders a great distance away from water. And they're a hunting spider, so they wander around. It's not a spider you expect to set up housekeeping and breeding in the house. But they're big and scary, really harmless. I would tell you, I'm not sure I'd handle one, because I think they do have the capacity to give you a nip if they feel threatened. But they're not aggressive. They're not going to run after you. And so, as I said, most of the time you can just kind of shoo them away. But definitely from the size, and as I said, to me, the distinguishing thing is that that banding pattern on the legs. This is a species of fishing spider.
Very, 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 very cool. And we've got, I don't know, this one's a little dark. What's this bug? We call it a stink bug because it stinks when you touch it.
So what's the giveaway to me on this one? If I can see the hind legs, there's a little flaring. And this puts it in the family that we call the leaf-footed bugs. And this particular one is called the western conifer seed bug because it feeds on spruce and pine seeds. But in the fall of the year, it's notorious for trying to crawl into people's houses to spend the winter. And they do have a very distinctive odor, as many of the true bugs do when you crush them. But it's derived, I'm sure, from some of the things it's feeding on in the resins on the pine tree. And it is related. There is a family of true bugs we call the stink bugs. This is not a, quote, true stink bug, but it turns out that the leaf-footed bugs do have a distinctive odor if crushed.
Phil Pelletieri, our guest today, talking about the world of insects with him. You can join us at 1-800-642-1234. Let's turn to Sean in Wausau next. Hi, Sean. Thank you for calling.
Hey, thanks for taking my call. Mr. Pelletieri, I was wondering if you could give us any idea on when we may be able to go back to the Northwoods and actually enjoy sitting outside.
If it keeps raining like this, I'm not so sure.
I mean, we were up there 2 weekends ago. My kids were outside for 5 minutes. It looked like they had mumps when they came back in.
Yeah, I mean, in particular, the mosquito populations in this first surge is about as intense as it can be. You know, we had a very heavy snow cover. So when that all melted off, there's lots of woodland ponds. So that first wave we define as the snowmelt mosquitoes. And what's nice about snowmelt mosquitoes is that there's only one wave. Now, if that's all that was going on, you'd say, well, it takes 3 to 4 weeks to settle down. But the unfortunate thing is with these rainfall patterns we get, when we start getting flooding again and we're holding water in spaces for more than a couple of weeks, then the next wave, what we call floodwater mosquitoes, come. And that's where my fear is that depending on what happens in the next couple of days, in particular, we're starting to see, you know, areas that have picked up 3-4 inches of rain already in the last couple of days, and we might have another couple of days of rain. Then you can usually figure 2 weeks from now, the next wave is coming. And so, as I said, it all depends on weather patterns. But if it stays on the wet side and especially the flooding side, all you're doing is providing more habitat for mosquitoes.
Yep. There you go. Thank you, Sean. Phil Pelletieri, our guest. I'm Larry Mueller. Carl Christensen, our on-air producer. You're listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Thanks for listening in on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm Larry Mueller with my guest, entomologist Phil Pelletieri, answering your insect questions. Join in. You can go to my Facebook page at The Larry Mueller Show. I would suggest you go there anyway because there are some fantastic photos that people are sending in of various insects. And, Phil, we have one here from somebody who says, this is, well, near Blue Mounds. It's about an inch long, found it on our patio door. And so, I can't even describe it.
Well, yeah. And so the first thought is it looks like an alien. But honestly, it's a moth. Oh. It's an adult moth. And I'm not sure the family. I would have to reference my books. And the problem is there's upwards of about 1,500 species of moths. But it's either a Lasocampid or a Noctuid. It would be the two families I would look for. And what's unique about this, the fuzziness of the legs was kind of a giveaway to me. The way it's holding its wings, it almost looks like it has a piece of leaf on it, but that's the marking in the front forewing, which would be very distinctive in helping to identify this creature. And then again, all the hairs off the back end and along the thorax. So there are some species of moths that really are very fuzzy like this. And as I said, the pattern that is holding its wings and whatnot makes it look very different. But there's no question in my mind that is a moth. And as I said, those two families have some representatives that would fit this, but that's a neat picture.
That is a really neat picture, and I was certain that was a piece of a leaf and not
yeah.
a wing.
Oh, no, and that's part of the camouflage that's going on here for as far as the moth's concerned.
That's really cool. Let's take a call from Keith in Dodgeville next. Keith, hi. Thank you for calling.
Yes, thank thank you. I got a question about black flies, the biting gnats. We never used to have them down here. The last couple of years, they just keep getting worse. Mm-hmm. I only remember them from up north. So my question is, how come they're moving south when the global warming is supposed to be chasing them north? And what do they need for breeding?
Okay,
they
so
sure are nasty biters.
It's complicated because black fly is technically a family of biting flies. And we have upwards of about 25 to 30 species in the state. They always require moving water, creeks, rivers, streams. They do not breed in lakes. The last couple years, I have noticed in the southern part of the state some very significant black fly numbers of some of the bird feeding species. And by as a group, as a family, most of them are bird feeders. So the bird feeding species will hover around you, but they won't bite you. There's only about three or four species in that family that are people biters. I, luckily enough, have not run into the people biters yet this spring, although I will tell you that every time I'm out and about in the woods, I've got a hat on because there have been so many black flies. And I do know my friends that are rearing bluebirds have had quite a bit of bluebird mortality. Mm-hmm. There was an article in the paper recently, the DNR reported about the high loon problems where there's a specific species that bothers loons has been so aggravating to the nesting birds that they're going off nest. And so they expected a very poor recruitment year. So you get these, and as I said, that's what complicates the story. With a number of different species, you have good years, bad years, but in Dodgeville, you're paying for the ones that are coming off the Wisconsin River. I know it,
sure.
Because, as I said, the species that's causing the problems on the bluebirds is coming off the Wisconsin River. But you don't have to be next to the river. One of the interesting things about black flies is you can see them blow 20, 30, 40 miles. In fact, in Alaska, there's documentations of them going 200 to 300 miles from the river breeding site and showing up. And so, you know, usually it's a 2 to 3 week black fly season for a particular species. You pray for good windy days because they don't do so well in the wind, and that kind of lessens it. But historically, there are black flies anywhere there's moving water. There's a lot of problems down in Iowa with some of the streams they've got up in New England. And as I said, I think you've just been blessed. But I have also noticed the last couple of years have been bad, and it'll be interesting to see. Last year, I think there was not a good year for a lot of birds because the bird feeding species caused mortality on the chicks, and I would not be surprised to see the same thing this year, at least from what I've seen so far.
Maureen and Eau Claire, thanks for calling. Hi.
Hi. My question is regarding mosquitoes. My grandson had a severe allergic reaction to them. He lives in the Stoughton area, but he came up to Eau Claire for Camp Nana, and the reaction was minimal. Mm-hmm. Is there a difference in areas and maybe perhaps the mosquito?
Well, I don't know if this has ever been scientifically proven, but again, with well over 50 species in the state, and each one has its own salivary components, one would not be surprised that one particular species might have a protein that your grandson reacts very severely to, and then some of the species up your way not. So, you know, and again, your immune system goes back and forth, but you'd expect it, as I said, because one mosquito species you could expect we might understand. But when you start putting multiple species, there's so many variables in there that would not surprise me one bit.
I see. Thank you.
Yep. Thanks a lot for calling. Back to the Larry Mueller Show Facebook page for a minute here. Phil, we have a very bright red, about a quarter of an inch.
So I know this is a velvet mite and the family that it comes from. And it's an interesting group. Honestly, the chiggers belong to this group, but we saw a lot of these last year. And most of these are either insect predators or pollen feeders. And they are extremely bright red. And if you get them under the microscope, they look like a very fine velvet. I mean, you can see some napping to their body or little tiny hairs. Quite fast moving, especially the predators, because they got to chase down their prey. Often you see them down in leaf litter and the like. If you squish them, they leave red, but it's not like the hemoglobin in our blood. It's a different pigment that's associated with it. But a neat picture, and as I said, nothing to worry about. And most of the time, especially
really bright red.
Yes, yes,
really bright red. Tim and Hammond, your turn. Hi, Tim.
Hello. I have a question about the best I can describe it would be a flying beetle. I was standing at a football game a year and a half ago or so in September, and it was kind of just dusk. And I was talking to someone. The game was over, and I felt something hit my shoulder. And at first I thought somebody had thrown something at me. I mean, it was some weight I felt hit me. And then for some reason, I don't know if I felt something, but I brought my hand up, and I felt something on my shoulder, and I kind of just brushed it off. And then I saw some motion, and then I looked over on the ground, and here was this thing. I'd never seen something so big. The body itself was probably 4 inches long. If you take the legs into account, it was probably 6 inches. It was fairly flat, dark green, greenish-brown color. And the thing was just huge. I pointed it out to some people, and some kids saw it and kind of screamed. And I'd just never seen such a thing before. And do they bite? And do you know what this thing would have been?
Well, I've got two thoughts. My first one, and I'm more confident in this, is I wonder if it was a giant water bug, because they're often reported to people as being like a large beetle. And the timing of the year would fit, because giant water bugs in the fall migrate from small ponds and the like to big rivers and larger bodies of water. The way you could confirm it is, instead of having a chewing mouth part, they've got a big beak like a mosquito, and they're predators, and they could bite. I it's hard to get them to bite, but I would not want to be bit by one, because I mean, they can kill a 5-inch trout with their salivary component. So it would be a very painful experience. So that would be my first guess, but they tend to be a flat brown color. The green part of it, you know, then I start thinking big things in the fall and like, and then, but I think you would just, this doesn't look beetle-like to me as a praying mantis, you know, and mantids are not typically native to this state, but in the last 10 years or so, we know where they're breeding in the southern part of the state, the Chinese mantid in particular. But that is more of an elongated creature, great big gangly legs, great big front legs, great big beady eyes. So they said, look up giant water bug and see if that would fit. And they're commonly attracted. They're also called electric light bugs because they're attracted to big lights. And again, at a football game, you probably have the lights on. So there's reasons to believe that the one would be in the neighborhood, aside from this, the time of the year being good.
Yeah, there you go. Thanks,
Thank
Tim.
You.
Yeah, thanks a lot for calling. And Annalisa in Green Bay. Hi, thank you for calling. Are you there? Oh, I wonder if we lost her. Seems pretty dead. Well, let's try Ernest in Vernon County. Ernest, hi.
Good morning, gentlemen. Phil, my question concerns ticks that have fallen off my German Shepherd dog, and they're engorged. They've let go. I know they seek his blood for raising their young, but I have placed them in different, they don't walk away, and I've placed them in the yard and checked on them regularly, and they just lay there, and I'm confused as with that behavior. Can you explain, what am I missing?
I'm not sure they're capable. They are so engorged with blood, and they swell up so much like a balloon, I don't see how they can move with their little tiny legs and the like. So what usually will happen if you know, when somebody sends me an engorged tick and I don't dispose of it and it's sitting in a jar for a couple, 3 weeks, all of a sudden I'll go back, and the female will lay upwards of a couple thousand eggs, and it will kill her. You know, basically the process of getting, so they don't go through multiple cycles like mosquitoes and the like. And then those eggs will hatch after, depending on the season of the year, a few weeks to the next spring. And then they hatch as a little larvae. And then they're somewhat mobile. But basically the way the ticks go from point A to point B, the easiest is hitchhiking on the animals as they feed. So that's where you get the dispersal. The tick themselves, because they can't fly, are very poor walkers. But the adults, as I said, an adult female that's engorged, can they move a few inches? Yes, but not much more than that. As I said, I think they're just so distended from the blood meal, they're pretty much trapped at being in the general area that they're dropped off.
Okay, I'll put one in a jar for 2 to 3 weeks and see what happens.
See what happens.
Yeah, try to keep them a little on the dry side. Sometimes in jars where things don't, you know, the humidity gets up too high, they'll get moldy and die. Yeah. But as I said, if you can put it, you will see it in, you know, the eggs will be round, spherical, and, you know, you can watch them lay them. You know, even the laying process takes upwards of a couple, 3 days.
Wow.
But,
amazing. All right. Well, thanks for your information, and I'll take that and work with that.
All right. Thanks, Ernest, for calling. And Roger in Little Chute. Hello.
Hello. I've got a problem with what look like large black ants in my house, and I've used a product like Home Defense, and that seems to kill them. But they keep coming back, and I'm wondering what could be their source or what kind of – is it actually an ant or what the heck is it?
It's probably a carpenter ant. In the big question, you know, the easy thing for me to say as far as the solution is you find the nest, you kill the queen, and you solve the problem. The question, though, is the nest in a tree that's 50 yards in the backyard and the ants are just migrating in the house looking for food, or do you have a bad windowsill or something and the ants are living there? And so usually in these cases, we try to walk through when do the first ants appear? How many ants do you see? Are they mostly in the kitchen or are you seeing numbers in other parts of the house? Those are all pieces of evidence. You know, if the first ant showed up 2 weeks ago and you only see them in the kitchen, then the source is probably outside and you can spray all you want and all you're doing is killing the occasional worker that comes in. You're really not getting at the heart of the problem. You know, I have an information sheet on carpenter ants at my website or the Diagnostic Lab website. I'm retired, but it's even do Wisconsin carpenter ants. You can come up with it. And it's about 4 pages and it'll walk you through, you know, the places to look for, the patterns to look for, and then you can go. There are some baits that can be used. They're not hard to kill. If you know where they're coming from and you can spray it, 2 squirts of Raid would solve the problem. But it takes quite a bit of detective work. And over time, you make observations to make a more educated guess where they come from. But ultimately, that's what needs to be done. On the other side, pest control services do have sprays they can put on the outside of the house in the spring that will solve the problem, either or. But these sprays are not available to the general public. And so, as I said, if you get particularly frustrated, that would be an option. But for now, I think it's very well worth trying to do some of this work yourself and see if you can solve the problem.
Sure, why not? Thanks, Roger. And Darlene in Tomahawk. Hi.
Hi, Larry. I'm calling because I'm trying to figure out, lately, in the past 3 weeks or so, I have been inundated with giant horse flies going around the hummingbird feeders that are hanging under my upstairs porch. And I'm afraid that they're chasing the hummers away because they're the size of bees. What can I do?
Well, this is going to be a tough one.
I mean, we're talking 3 hummer feeders, and it's fresh hummingbird food, and maybe 10 or 12 horseflies.
That's a little surprising to me only because so horseflies are all about motion. And in particular, as you know, when you kind of are walking out and all of a sudden they're on you. But I'm not used to seeing patrolling bird situations, or especially if the hummers aren't there. Now, the good news about horseflies, even though we've got a number of species in the state, is they are quite seasonal. And so one would expect once you get out to 3 to 4 weeks, a given species will be pretty much done with its adult stage. And so maybe they'll just run their course, but I really don't know. And then the other thing is they tend to like more sunny open areas. And so, you know, the more sheltered I would think that the feeder would be, the less problem. Now, if this persists, then I guess I would say it would be really neat if you could catch one of these things. Let's just be sure it's a horsefly. Because there's, you know, these big flies and so many things look alike. And I'll tell you, flies in particular are a difficult group to properly identify because we have to look at their wing veins and so many things look like things that they're not. But, you know, it is the season for horse flies. I'm just surprised that they would waste their time trying to catch.
I have a hard enough time trying to swat them. They're so fast.
Yeah. Yeah. But, I, you know, as I said, just the way they work, I would think a hummingbird could outfly a horsefly half the time. And as I said, I don't remember seeing reports of them having any interest in feeding on birds in particular. They're looking for large animals, deer, horses, and people.
Well, I know, but they're landing on the feeders.
So they're eating the feed?
Yeah, see, that's what suggests to me that it's not a horsefly, because horseflies are all about blood, and sweet water is not something I would expect to attack them. Yeah. So as I said, if you get any chance, either take a picture if one is busy feeding, and then email it down and said, well, give it to PJ right now, is running the lab, and he can take a look at it. But there's that behavior is suggesting to me it's not a true horsefly.
There you go. Thank you so much for calling. Another photo on Facebook from James, lucky enough to see some dragonflies hatching up north a few weeks back. And that's a cool picture for sure. Do they go for the mosquitoes? Please say yes.
Oh, that, you know, I know the bird people get mad at me, but the purple martins get too much good press that they don't deserve. But dragonflies are the ultimate mosquito-eating machine, both in the larval and the adult stage. They feed on small gnats. They live in wet environments. And so, as I said, they definitely are something you want to try to promote. Unfortunately, nobody's ever come up with a way to commercially produce dragonflies successfully because, as I said, I think we would all love to be able to buy a bucket of dragonflies to let go in your backyard to take care of things. But unfortunately, nature doesn't quite always work the way we want it to.
Mike in Madison, hello to you. Thanks for calling.
Yeah, we caught a praying mantis last year, and that was one of the funnest pets, most fun pets we ever had for the kids. Just caught some moths, you know, and threw it in the cage. But got me thinking, are there any insects like other natural creatures that can't be pets that are kind of protected?
Really, the only ones, the DNR has a very short list. You know, the Karner blue butterfly, there are some rules as far as capturing them and whatnot, so they're not something. But unless it's really endangered, no.
Gotcha.
So, and, you know, the mantids, it's an interesting one. I'm very much waiting what's going to happen at the end of this summer, because when people were throwing the question to me, what effect would you expect the winter to have on insects? In general, we didn't expect much, but one of the insects that came to mind that may have had a tough time getting through are the mantids. And, you know, back when I started 40 years ago, we had no breeding mantids in the state. And what we would find is that these egg cases that they lay, which looks kind of like a golf ball, but it's very soft and spongy, would freeze out. But in the last 10 years, with the mild winters, they haven't been freezing out. And that's when all of a sudden we said, hey, we've got breeding populations in the southern third of the state and also up in Door County because of the tempering effect of the lake. But as I said, I'm kind of scratching my head, and it would not surprise me that their numbers would be getting knocked back pretty extremely, because these egg cases are out in the open. They're usually laid on twigs and the like, and so they got exposed to some pretty cold weather. So as I said, it will be interesting to see. But barring, again, moving back to real severe winters, I expect them, even if they did freeze out, they'll be back.
There you go. I guess along that line, too, the emerald ash borer, I remember earlier in the winter people talking about how it might be cold enough to kind of knock down the numbers. Is there any sign of that yet?
Well, if you read into it, the kind of temperatures we needed is minus 25, minus 30, minus 35. So in the very far northern part of the state, we may expect to get a positive bounce from it. But the bottom line is, in the southern two-thirds of the state, we didn't get cold enough, even though it was plenty cold, but we didn't get cold enough. And in fact, one of the concerns we've had is that there's been a couple beneficial wasp species that attack emerald ash borer that have been brought in, and they don't do as well in the winter as emerald ash borers. So of anything, my worry is more that some of the good guys got knocked out in the southern part of the state rather than emerald ash borer.
There you go, Mike. Thanks a lot for calling. Appreciate it very much. And Annalisa in Green Bay, hello.
Hi. I have a question. Something is eating my knockout roses, and I thought they were supposed to be pretty carefree and disease-free. Can you help me with that?
The eating the flowers or eating the leaves, or what are you seeing?
The leaves.
Okay. If I had to guess this time of year, roses and apples are the two plants that come to mind. I can come up with a list of 100 different things that will eat them. And they're just very insect prone. Usually in May and early June, there is a rose sawfly, which is a type of worm-like larvae that feeds and it causes the leaves to brown. It's kind of like they just take the surface off it. But it's interesting, when they first do the feeding, it's kind of just a lighter green. You don't notice it, but then it eventually browns up. So just about the time you see brown leaves curling on your plant, they've already been done for 2 weeks. Now, the good news, if that's what's there, is it's cosmetic. I mean, it won't kill the plants. The plants will do well. But I will tell you, next year, the chance of them being back is quite high. It's one of these insects that seems to be there every spring. And so you can treat it in mid-May. Various garden sprays, even soapy water would probably do a good job if you get good coverage. But as I said, it looks a lot worse than it is, if that's indeed what was going on. But it's all a timing thing. And I'm guessing right now, unless you were to turn leaves over and see this little half-inch long yellowish green worm, I'd say, well, they're still there. But I'm guessing that they may have already left.
There you go.
Oh, okay.
All right. Thanks a lot for calling. And, oh, my goodness, we have some open lines for you at 1-800-642-1234. It's 1-800-642-1234. Give us a call. We'll get you on real quickly here. We have lots of calls, though, lots of Facebook comments and email questions. By the way, James posted a video on Facebook of a dragonfly hatching. I haven't looked at it yet, but Carl looks pretty good. Carl's got to give me a thumbs up. He said it's a really cool video. So if you want to see that, please go to the Facebook page. Phil, in an email, lives in La Crosse and is a very active cyclist, noticing a large amount of gnats encountered when he's on some of the bike trails. Will they die out eventually as summer goes on? Is this something that will last through the summer?
Okay, so gnat is a generic term for a small little flying thing. And I think that possibly what they're running into is a swarming phenomena where you will find just this incredible cloud of these little fly-like creatures. And to me, the question is, what's the species? Now, generally, the way most insects work is that the adults are active for a couple, 3 weeks, so they will be quite seasonal. But we've got hundreds of species. And so, as I said, when somebody asked me what was it, you know, I could say lake fly or fungus gnat or march fly or, you know, there's a whole bunch of them do it. And so I almost have to see the critter. But as I said, generally, these are mating swarms, probably all males, and then the females come to visit. We used to tease. They're like a singles bar. But they don't do well in the wind. You'll often see them use visual signals or cues to swarm. So sometimes you come by in the late afternoon and there is a cloud of critters above a rock every day when it's sunny.
Yeah.
Now, again, when it's windy, they're not there. When it's cloudy and rainy, they're smart enough not to come out there. But these swarming phenomena can go on. You can even see pictures sometimes up in the Canadian lakes where there's a column that is 20 yards wide and 50 yards tall. I mean, it's wow. Like this big smoke thing of the gnats. And as I said, different species are involved, but usually all they're doing is doing this behavior for mating purposes, and they would all be considered seasonal. As I said, I don't know of any species you'd expect to be emerging all summer long and doing that.
Debbie on Facebook wondered if there's a way to control rose chafers that are eating her heritage raspberries, apples, and beets.
Okay, so rose chafer is our native Japanese beetle, if you want to think about what it will do. And we only find it in sandy ground in the state. It comes up a little bit earlier. Usually it starts emerging about the 10th, 15th of June, so the timing is just perfect. Now, if you've heard us talk before, we are not a big fan of Japanese beetle traps because they make things worse rather than better. But I am a fan of rose chafer traps.
Oh.
You can buy these traps. They look just like Japanese beetle traps, but they use a different lure. They get caught in there, and basically you're kind of draining off the adult population. You need to put them away from your plants. You don't want to put the trap in the middle of your garden because then you're just drawing them in. The trouble is finding the traps. There is a company called Great Lakes IPM out of Michigan that will sell traps. That would be, in a perfect world, we could have done this a month ago and you could have had mail ordered and at your house before they start to emerge. But that will work, as will, you know, there are sprays, but it's that same complication with Japanese beetle is that you get 3 or 4 days of control and then more keep coming at you. And rose chafers are flying in. So that's definitely another one of these headaches that you've got no control of the population. So as I said, I would look into those traps because, I mean, ultimately, I think you'll find you can often draw the numbers down enough that you don't have. I won't say that you won't have any, but you'll have few enough that you won't have to worry about any kind of plant damage.
Entomologist Phil Pelletieri, our guest. I'm Larry Mueller here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Great to have you along on the Ideas Network as we take a look at the world of insects with entomologist Phil Pelletieri. And all of our lines are filled. We have lots of wonderful photos, Phil, on the Facebook page. Oh, my goodness.
You know, the neat thing, the digital camera was probably the greatest invention that I have seen in my career. And, you know, the reason I became an entomologist, among other things, is when you start looking at a lot of these what appear very small, ugly things, and you get a good close-up, they're just amazing. And some of these pictures, I think people can see the kind of things that so the top one is a tiger beetle. And all the tiger beetles
really
are metallic
cool.
To one degree or another. There is a site that will help you identify the tiger beetles of Wisconsin. They're predators. They feed on caterpillars and cutworms and all kinds of things like that. They are extremely quick creatures. In fact, they're very difficult to capture most of the time. When I used to go out collecting them, it takes two people. You notice if you walk, they kind of fly out ahead of you, and then they land and they turn and they're looking at you. So you basically use one person to push them, and then the other person with the net sneaks up from behind. But neat creatures. And as I said, it's interesting when we first started talking about metallic green beetles, you know, people thought anything that was metallic green had to be an emerald ash borer. Well, here's a classic example of a native beneficial insect that's bright green and shiny, but is definitely not a bad guy.
And then Ed sent us a Luna moth and also a fly.
Okay, so we use the term sometime picture wing flies because there's a number of species of flies that have just incredibly ornate wings. Some of the picture wing flies, there's a particular family of those. There's also some of the gall-making flies have some very ornate. So without seeing it, I can think of four or five possible families of flies this thing could come from. But again, the patterns are just amazing. And sometimes you even get some metallic coloring in some of these flies and the like. And so they said, I can't tell you exactly which one, but it comes out of one of those groups, one of the Tephritids or one of the other families.
Scott in Milwaukee, thank you for calling. Hello.
Good morning, gentlemen. I got an easy one for you. I have a very small garden, and it has some flowers, a little bit of hostas, and some vegetables. And I was wondering if it's beneficial in any way to go down to the local bait shop, get some worms, some red worms or some earthworms, and just put them in the garden.
Okay. So this is honestly a somewhat controversial issue because earthworms are not native to Wisconsin. Any earthworms got killed because of the ice age and the like. And so there is major concerns about releasing these exotic worms in natural settings because they change the ecology. On the other hand, if you talk about an agricultural setting, earthworms are very important. They help recycle nutrients. They help to aerate the soil. So there's all kinds of good things about earthworms in certain settings. But as I said, out in the woods and natural landscapes, definitely not. In gardens, you know, you would say yes, they do. So now, usually you would expect it by this time, especially in Milwaukee, that I would expect that when you go digging, do you see an occasional worm at times?
Yeah, we have quite a few when we till up the soil. We see quite a few in there.
So I don't know if I would add anything to it other than, you know, if you add mulch and other things to the soil to create a better environment, to be honest, you're going to be a better place for the worms. There's more for them to eat, everything else. And so I think that would be the direction I'd go rather than bringing in some exotic worms into the environment.
Mm-hmm.
All right. Thank you.
Yep, thanks a lot for calling. Barb in Oshkosh, thank you for calling. Hi.
Hi. What a great program again. I have a question about those yellow jackets. They come in the fall.
Mm-hmm.
They're wasps. I'm allergic to them, and we had a nest of them. They must have been between the brick and the house somehow, like at the very end of the brick, you know, just as it ended before it came to, like, the sliding glass doors of our patio.
Sure.
And my husband used up, I'm not kidding, four big cans of wasps. Going out every night trying to kill them.
Sure.
I never managed to do it. And because I'm allergic to them, I was always scared to death around my yard. Are they going to be back this year? Should we get a professional to do something in there?
Okay, so two things. What you have basically is a paper wasp that lives in the ground typically. But if it can find a space and get access, they'll make a paper wasp nest in your walls or any other place. So the first thing I would suggest to you is you've got openings like that. If they're there now, plug them, because these things start from scratch in the spring with a queen. So you've got the environment they show up. They don't come back to the old nest. So that's the first thing, is if you don't let them in the first place, you don't have a problem. If we get into August and all of a sudden you discover all those little stinkers have found a new place to get in, for any nest that I cannot see, I don't like sprays. They don't get in the right place. What I would have advised you is to use a dust and to dust the entrance in the late, early evening so that they have to walk through the dust, and that would have solved the problem. So it's kind of a setting. Now, the other thing, if you would have called me on the 1st of October, I'd say they're going to die out naturally in a week or two. Why bother? So, you know, timing year, what they're doing sometimes influences it. But I would say is to prevent it is you seal things up, and if something gets past you, instead of bothering with a spray for this type of thing. Sprays are great for a big nest that's out in front of you and you can see it. But for a nest you can't see, as I said, if it's in a hole in the ground, going in a wood pile or anything else, you dust the entrance, and then the dust will take care of them as they come and go.
Mm-hmm.
Thank you very much.
Thanks a lot for calling. And Ann in Greenfield. Hi, thank you for calling.
Hi there. Excellent show. I wanted to ask, I have a large rose garden, and of course, the bane of my existence is the constant spraying for aphids. And I had seen advertisements to get, you know, buy large amounts of the ladybugs.
Mm-hmm.
Does that work, or do they all fly away?
Yeah, they tend to fly away. It's interesting. What I tend to find and tell people, if you are a patient person, the ladybugs and the other good guys will show up, guaranteed. And, you know, it was interesting last year in particular, it was a bad aphid spring because of the weather. If you get a cool spring, the aphids are breeding and doing their thing, and all the good guys that eat them don't get started. I mean, they need it to be warmer. And so usually when you get about this time of the year, the tables are turned and the good guys show up. The species that you buy commercially, we already have here, so you're not adding anything new. They have been hibernating. They were caught when they were clustering together, and their first behavior is to leave. And in other words, even if they don't want to leave, they're not going to stick around if there's no food. So it's kind of, you're better to promote the natural native ones than you are to buy the commercial ones. It won't hurt anything, but it's just kind of, to me, wasting your money.
Got it. So how do I attract? Is there a way to attract ladybugs?
You know, when people ask this question and you look at it from an ecological standpoint, the more diverse habitat you have, the better chance you've got of having ladybugs. Because part of it is that when there's not aphids on your roses, if there's aphids on some other plant around, there would be lady beetles there that were doing their thing, and then they'd be in the neighborhood already. So it's kind of providing them a food source all summer long to help promote the numbers. Now, you know, if you got a small yard like I do, you're kind of limited as far as how diverse things can be, you know. Whereas if you're lucky enough to have a, you know, 3-acre prairie behind you, those are the kind of habitats that tend to promote the good guys.
Okay. All right. Well, thank you.
Yep. Thanks, Ann. Stuart in Libertyville, Illinois. Your turn. Hi.
Hi. Thank you for taking my call. I was calling. I have a kid's playset out in the backyard that seems to be attracting carpenter bees. Like, they look like big bumblebees, but they make a little hole and they dig into the soft wood. We've tried spraying them several times, but they come back every season, and then they're very annoying, and then the kids don't want to play in the playset.
Yeah, the problem is probably the wood is softening up because that's what they're looking for. And it's interesting, you know, you being south maybe have dealt with this more, but carpenter bees have been a relatively recent phenomenon for me to deal with. And again, it's one of these insects that I equate to kind of the lack of cold winters, and they move northward. Unfortunately, if you've got the right environment, there will be new queens coming out looking for those places every year. So sometimes people have had some luck by painting things and kind of getting them sealed up. If the wood was particularly bad, it could be replaced. Or then the other option is you fight the fight every spring. As soon as they start to make their burrows, you dust, not spray. Again, it's like those yellow jackets. We find that dusting tends to work much more efficiently in killing the queens in the spring when it gets started, and that should help shut the door. So you want to be pretty aggressive early, and that should save you misery for the rest of the year.
Mm-hmm. Perfect. Well, thank you very much for your help.
Yep, thanks a lot for calling. Back to Facebook for a minute. Julie sent us a nice picture of a butterfly that she saw at Devil's Lake.
Yeah, so that one is called a red-spotted purple. And indeed, if you had the wings, look at the other side, there are some red spots on the underside of the wings.
Top side are dark blue and light blue?
Yeah, I mean, this critter almost looks like a swallowtail, but it lacks the little tails off the end. And now, in the northern part of the state, there's a subspecies of this that has white bands in the wings, and they call it a white admiral. And I was always, as a kid, jealous about the kids that could catch those, because you don't find them down in this part of the state, but they're more prevalent north of Wausau. And again, it is basically the same red a subspecies of that same creature.
And Ernest sent a shot of a beetle that is really a cool-looking beetle here.
Yeah, so
black, shiny.
This comes from, I'm a beetle
guy.
Looks
like a rhinoceros almost.
Well, you know, it's in the same family. This is a scarab. In fact, this is a dung beetle in particular, if you had to give it a common name. And many of the dung beetles are brightly colored, some more than these, you know, metallic greens with reds and stuff. You know, I can tell it's a dung beetle from the antennae as much as anything else. And that's a great shot. He was on his hands and knees. I mean, because this is not an insect that most people would recognize, but probably about the size of your thumbnail. And as I said, many of them are very, very brightly colored. It's always funny when you think where you really have to go looking for them is in animal waste, and so that association often turns people off. But so definitely a dung beetle, and we have a number of species in the state. And as I said, there in worldwide, there are some just amazing species. Some of the ones that are a little more common down south, like Phanias, are just absolutely amazing. Look like jewels. That's the best way to describe them.
Oh, man. Elizabeth, hi. Thanks for calling from Madison. Are you there, Elizabeth? Oh, wait a second. Here we go.
Okay. Can you hear me now?
Have you got a quick question?
Yes. I'm getting some insect bites where I do not see the insect or hear it. The bite is red and itches, but it's not raised like a mosquito bite. And I'm wearing socks, and I'm stuffing my long pants inside the socks and stuffing my long sleeve shirt inside my pants. And I'm still getting some of these bites, like on my inner thigh and places where I wouldn't think a bug could get to.
Mm-hmm. Okay, what do you think, Phil?
You know, it's tough. If you're doing that kind of protection, it rules a bunch of things out outside. You know, I always tell people you got to be a little cautious because sometimes look things that look like bites that are not. But this time of the year, if I'm getting mysterious bites, and I'm pretty convinced they're bites, bird mites. There's a parasitic mite associated with birds, and if so, if there's a robin nest outside your bedroom window, one can come crawling in and pick on you, and it's extremely frustrating because they're small. I mean, you can see them. You don't feel the bites necessarily, but you get the reaction. So the only way you can prove it is with a little piece of glued cardboard and try to capture one to prefer. That's what's going on.
Phil Pelletieri, our guest. We'll be back with Phil right after this look at the news. Stay with us here on the Ideas Network. So happy to have you with us here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm Larry Mueller. My guest, UW entomologist Phil Pelletieri, former director of the UW Insect Diagnostic Lab, talking with him about the world of insects today, and certainly inviting your questions and comments as we move along. All our lines are filled right now. You can go to my Facebook page at The Larry Mueller Show, post a photo or a question there, and I hope you'll, even if you don't have a photo, I hope you'll go to the page because there are so many cool photos of insects that we have up from this particular show. I think you're just going to enjoy taking a look at them. James in Wausau has a question for you, Phil, so let's go there. Hi, James.
Hello. This is a bug behavior question. A couple of weeks ago, I was doing dishes in a double sink with the wash water on one side and a rinsing rack on the other. And I was almost done when a spindly spider came walking across that area, maybe an inch and a half across with a quarter-inch body, tan-colored. And it turned and walked across the median between the two basins and then seemingly deliberately went into the hot wash water, and that was the end of the spider. So I'm curious that it didn't seem to have any heat sensors.
Yeah, no, I that seems like a very foolish thing. If anything, you would think they would tend to go the other way. And, you know, when you said it was spindly, now, I thought for a second, you see jumping spiders, and, you know, they kind of hop instead, and they're very visual, and they see their prey and say, well, maybe it's all reflection thought. But when you get into spindly-type spiders, they don't work that way. And as I said, it just seemed to be like a very foolish decision, and can't think any reason why it would. Because, you know, their prey, they're not using heat at all. They're either movement or in some cases, the ones that use webs, they can, you know, they can sense that there's something there, but it's nothing to do with heat.
Hmm. There you go. Thank you, James. On to Stephanie in Beloit. Hi, Stephanie.
Hi there. I have two different herbivory problems. I'll start with the first one is my pole beans. Something is in some cases, chopping a whole big leaf off. In other cases, just making little holes. And I'm wondering if what the life cycle of the critter is and if there's some environmental things I can do to prevent these guys.
And it's happening now?
Yeah.
Boy, I'm taking a wild guess. It could be a cutworm. But pole beans are really kind of insect-proof most of the time. Now, you know, I'll tell you that as long as they're not feeding on flowers, that, you know, losing up to 20% of the leaves will not affect your yield. So the question, first of all, do you have to do anything? But the problem with cutworms is they're crawling in from around the area. Typically, what attracts the moths of the cutworm are weedy, grassy areas, and they'll lay their eggs there. and then the larvae will migrate out. So the only thing I could think of is they said trying to keep your borders and whatnot mowed or worked in a way that it's not attractive to start it. But that's
okay,
a guess.
So they come in as a flying insect, is that right?
No, the cutworm is a caterpillar. It is a crawling up. Yeah,
well,
the adult
crawl from the grass to the beans.
Right,
okay.
Right.
Okay. The other thing is intriguing. I started some foxgloves flowers in cell packs, and they're very tiny, you know, seed. And when they got to be about a quarter of an inch across with a couple sets of leaves, something came from, and these were started in clean soil. They've been up on a table outside. Something came and ate most of the leaves, and I'm trying to get them to come back. He didn't eat the stem. But I can't figure out how did something get to these guys if it wasn't in the soil? And it didn't eat all of them. I had several cell packs in this one.
Hmm.
Just don't know what could have come in there and done that.
Is it something that a little rodent or something could have gotten access, crawled up, and done a little bit of chewing?
Well, these are so tiny, I think I would have seen some, you know, disturbance of soil or the thing knocked over or something.
Yeah, like I just kind of at a loss. As I said, you know, part of it is, you know, so many of the insects are dependent on the adults laying their eggs close to what the food source is, and this all happens so quick, and it really isn't that good a food source, and so, yeah, I'm really kind of stumped.
Okay, well.
well, doesn't happen very often, Phil, that Phil is stumped. But this time around, yeah, he needs, probably if you saw it.
Well, you know, and sometimes, again, unfortunately, we always kind of walk in a few days later for what was really going on. And if you're there at the right time, you know, this kind of case, I would always tell people to run out at night with a flashlight. I mean, you worry about earwigs and other things doing some pretty silly stuff.
Yeah.
Now, earwigs don't come out of the ground till about the Memorial Day holiday, typically here. In fact, it's interesting, in my own garden, I saw my first earwig yesterday, which isn't unusual. They come out of the ground half grown, and they eat at night and then disappear in the day. So, and they like succulent stuff. It could be, but as I said, to have a whole bunch of earwigs run up like that and do it and not see kind of earwigs around wouldn't make sense to me.
Linda has sent a photo on Facebook again of wondering what kind of moth this is. Another really cool looking.
Sure. So it's in the sphinx or hawk moth family. If I was a hawk moth expert, I could give you the species right off the top. It looks like a walnut sphinx to me, but that's a bit of a guess. But I think if you go under the sphinx or hawk moth group and then kind of look through it, I'm sure you can get a proper identification. Many of them, when they hold their wings like that, they look like spaceships. I mean, they're just some
pretty
real neat ones going out there. And it's a relatively big family. I mean, everybody identifies the tomato hornworm, which is the one that is the most destructive one in the state. But we got a bunch of species that are feeding on various trees and other plants and really don't cause us any problem.
Ruby in Westby, thanks for calling. Hi.
Hi. I had a unique honeybee experience yesterday. I was driving on I-90 by Toma, and I saw this brown cloud coming at me, and it swooped down, and all of a sudden it hit my windshield, and it was just covered with these big splats, and it was mostly like clear wet liquid, and when I stopped to clean my windshield off, the grill of my truck was full of honeybees. None of them stuck to my windshield, but it was honeybees, and I was just wondering if they were like wild ones, or why they would swarm at this time of the year.
Okay, so really, honeybees are the only bee that swarms here, and you saw a true swarm. And it could be wild. It could be a somebody that was keeping the bees and didn't keep them properly. Because what this is basically a dividing process, where the queen will take off with a bunch of workers, and then there will be new queens produced. And so it's a way of splitting. But when they take off, they don't know where they're going. And so usually the swarm will collect on a spot, a fence post or a tree limb, and then the scout bees will go looking for a hollow tree or another place to move into, and even once in a while somebody's attic. And so when you see that kind of cluster of bees moving through, that's what you witnessed. And it's pretty typical this time of the year. I mean, this indicates it was a strong colony. Now, the interesting thing is,
it was about 10, 15 feet across and about 10 feet tall.
Ooh, wow. Boy, that's a very large swarm.
The front of a Mack truck.
Yeah, Yeah, interesting. Well, you know, and the thing I tell people about the wild swarms is that, you know, 15 years ago, when we between the Varroa mites and all the other problems, we didn't see wild swarms. There was very few wild colonies, but it's something that has become more commonplace in the last few years, which suggests that we're starting to get some natural resistance in the honeybee population to some of these problems, not all the problems, but some of them. And so that's been very encouraging to see. But yeah, you know, it really would be impossible to tell if it was a true wild swarm separating from another colony, or it was a colony that the beekeeper wasn't caring for properly. Because, of course, it's like leaving the barn door open and all your cows go out. You don't want this to happen. And so there are ways that they can manipulate the colonies so that they will not go through the swarming process.
Uh-huh. The other thing I was amazed at is how much liquid was in them, because it was like it sounded like big raindrops hitting the windshield, and it was just the clear liquid just spread all over.
Well, some of it, they do have to take some food stores, just because, again, leaving the colony, they're leaving everything behind. And so, you know, I it wouldn't surprise me if the bees tend to engorge as much as they can so that they've got some fuel to kind of wane it out. Because the swarming process, if you ever see a swarm in your backyard, sitting on a bush or something, it's best to leave it alone, because usually within a day or two, they all find a place to move and they just disappear on their own. So why bother with them, type of thing? And so, you know, we hate to see people kind of overreact to swarms, because they said, given some time, they will move on.
Thanks again, Ruby. Jill in Green Bay, we turn to you next. Hi, Jill.
Hello.
Hi. What can we do for you?
Hi. Somehow we got pantry moths in our house. And it is about a year now. We still have them. We went through maybe in the fall and cleared out many of the cupboards and found areas where they were breeding and hiding places, washed everything out, and we still have them. I did a little reading on the internet and quite a bit of science, and like naturally it said you could put bay leaves in your cupboards or use essential oil. And I was just wondering, is there... Can you recommend or at least verify if pesticide companies can come in and aerate the house or something?
Yeah.
We have a cat, though.
Okay, so this is a problem. I do not find sprays are the answer. To be honest, I really haven't seen any science to suggest bay leaves will solve the problem. What it comes to is they breed on dried plant material. And so you went through your cleanup, which is the first thing you do. And we suggest two things to people. Is one is to put items that they potentially could get into containers that they can't. So, you know, Tupperware and plastic snap and screw top glass jars. Because if you don't, they're notorious that if a couple moths you didn't find get out, lay their eggs, they start the fire all over again. The other problem is they do find things that just don't catch your attention. And I've often related on the show in our own house. They started in birdseed in the garage. Eventually, they, you know, we got rid of the birdseed, fed it out, but they got into the cupboards, and we had to throw some noodles and rice out. And it wasn't a large number, but we'd see an occasional moth. And I did everything that I tell other people to do. And, of course, my wife was not impressed with my skills. But, you know, what it turned out to be, and it took 6 months for me to finally be enough of a detective, is I found a hardware store bag sitting on a counter that I would have sworn that there were screws in there. It was a hardware store bag. But really what it was vegetable seeds my father-in-law had given me 3 years before that. I forgot about them. Well, that's dried plant material. So that was the breeding source. So potpourri and Christmas wreaths made out of walnuts and, I mean, all these weird objects. When the kids are, you know, in kindergarten and they make these flower paste pitchers they bring home, and then, of course, you save it for them, you know, so when they're 30 years old, you can bring it out of the box. If those moths find that, they can breed in that. And so that's the frustrating part, is if you go through the cleanup and you start to have a problem 3-4 weeks after the cleanup, they have found something or you have overlooked something. And until you find that. So, you know, what I tease people about is if you got a bad box of Bisquick that's infested, you can spray all you want in the house. And if you don't get rid of the box of Bisquick, you still got moths.
Yeah.
So that's why, as I said, I'm not a big fan of spraying for this. You got to be a good detective. I realize it gets frustrating. But as I said, if you continue to see moths, they're breeding. They have found some kind of dried plant material that will sustain them.
There you go. Good luck, Jill. Thanks. Keep searching. Keep searching. Lee in Green Bay, hello.
Yeah, hello. I wanted to ask Phil if he's seen or had any experience with these little items you can buy called a bug zapper. They're like a tennis racket. You put two AA batteries in them, and you just, when the mosquitoes start coming around you, you just start swishing that baby around, and boy, they just crack and fry.
Mm-hmm. You know, a lot of revenge about treating them that way. They do work. You know, for every mosquito you kill, unfortunately, there's a few thousand other ones running out there. But yeah, there's nothing wrong with it. But I guess I would put them more in as an amusement type of thing than something that really controls. But if, you know, if it's an easy way to keep the mosquitoes away from, there's nothing wrong with it.
I'm telling you right now, one of the best ways, I think, if you're on a porch or something, we've got a big box fan, which I haven't gotten out yet, which I is going to be coming out tonight. because of, and you turn that box fan on, and they just don't like that wind.
Well, they're not strong enough flyers. You know, any wind speed above about 10 miles an hour and a mosquito has got problems. It just can't fly against it. So, yeah, you know, if you can set it up in the right case, it's ideal. You know, we've been spoiled in Madison. I'll tell you, locally, I've been somewhat surprised at the lack of mosquitoes compared.
Yeah.
Now, if you get down the Wisconsin River, I know people have said they won't even let people go out in canoes because it's so bad. And, you know, it's just a question of when. And as you said, it sounds like it's gotten going on the east side of Madison now. With all this rain, as I said, I'm not surprised. It was really, again. And in the northern part of the state, as I said, the reports I've been getting is been worse than it's been in quite some time. And this is normal bad mosquitoes. I mean, I guess I said I was not surprised considering how much snowfall we had in other things, which means lots of spring flooding, and that means lots of mosquitoes.
Tim in Portage, hello. Thank you for calling.
Hey, Larry, Phil. Just a lady looking for a way to attract more ladybugs. And I kind of came across it this by accident. I have a ditch that was too steep to be mowed. And I started planting all kinds of wildflowers into it, including milkweed and butterfly plants, which in turn I collected a lot of milkweed or a lot of butterflies and hummingbirds and other. I kind of added on to it and kept finding more and more native flowers to plant. And then I got carried away and started going down the roadsides and doing this. And I have a lot of beneficials around because of it. Mm-hmm. I now have a neighbor who has decided that it looks better if he mows it, and I've asked him not to, and he kind of gives me, as you say, the dirty looks and keeps mowing it anyway. But anyway, I'd like to start a movement. We should plant our roadside. There's hundreds of acres out here that could be, like you said, that want 3 acres of prairie in your backyard. There it is. It's right out in the front yard even.
Well, you know, the Department of Transportation has been doing some work and some investigating into ways they can have some more natural plantscapes in our medians. And, of course, they're worrying about maintenance issues, and they're also worrying about other things. You don't want, you know, creatures jumping out of there and getting in the way of people's cars. But ultimately, I think they're looking into it. And even we're talking certain species of butterflies are enhanced. And, again, it's a common ecological principle that the more diversity you've got, the more balanced things get. And so, yeah, it makes a lot of sense, and I'm hoping that they continue to investigate and find ways that they can do that, because, as I said, you just get all kinds of things, probably all kinds of benefits we don't even realize spins off by having that kind of diversity.
Mm-hmm. Yep. Thanks a lot, Tim. Gary in Waterloo, hello.
Yeah, Gary, you said?
Yes.
Oh, hi. Say, I ran into something the last couple of years. Bees. I first saw in my shop, I poked a hole in a wet spot in the ceiling, and these bees come out of there, and there were 3 or 4 different sizes. They looked like honeybees, but they were huge. They're big ones. The big ones are probably 1.5 inches or better in length, and then there are 3 or 4 different sizes of them. They're very aggressive. I also ran into in a compost pile I was digging in last fall. It was probably only 35, 40 degrees outside, and I had a lot of clothes on, and all of a sudden I'm covered with bees. They were stinging me. The only thing that got me in the back of neck and ears, because that's what it exposed. And now this spring I noticed them up in the attic of our house. We got a living quarters up there. Just big things are up there. And I had to tear a porch off the house that was just falling apart. And that thing was just packed with nests. I didn't see any bees, but it was just packed with nests in there. I'm wondering what these things are.
Okay, so they're not bees. They're wasps. They're paper wasps, one sort or another, and I've got 4 or 5 different kinds. Now, the difference, is honeybees can live for years. They create wax, they create honey, they get through the winter and survive as a colony. Where wasps start everything in the spring from a queen, colony builds all season long, they're really much more aggressive than bees if the nest is disturbed in particular. But the good thing is that they die in the winter, and then we start from scratch every year. And so,
yeah,
unfortunately,
kind of weird,
and especially, too, the mulch pile, you don't see honeybees would not set up a colony in a mulch pile. But if there's a little pocket in there, that's a great place for some of the ground nesting yellow jackets to try to go through. So, you know, if there's an area that they're active, this is a good time of the year to be aggressive because the colonies are very small. And you don't run much of a risk. In August and September, that's when there could be thousands of critters in there. And then again, if you run over them with a lawnmower or you rip the porch apart and they're in there. So you kind of look. If they're disappearing into a crack in the soffit, the best thing I can tell you this time of the year is, and only at this time of the year when it's early, is to get it sealed or to dust it so when they walk through, they get killed. If we are in September and you said there was a bunch coming and going in the soffit, the last thing I want to do is to seal it up because then you're going to force them through your light fixtures and other things. Then it's got to be treated. Or, as I said, if it's in a place that doesn't bother people, the best thing to do is don't mess with them because they'll leave me alone as long as they're not messed with. But so it's a good time of the year to watch what's going on. As I said, dust more than sprays for things that are going in the ground and disappearing to take care of things. And you're never quite sure because they can be in wall voids, attic spaces, nests in the ground, wood piles if there's a pocket, or the mulch pile. And but it's all about the late summer where the worry is. And you know, the difference between bees and wasps may not make a big difference to you, but the way their biology is, it makes a lot of difference as far as what we have to do with them, where you expect to find them. In those old nests, who cares? They don't come back to them. You can just let that be.
And thanks a lot for calling, Gary. Appreciate your call. Earl on Facebook wondered, when are row covers needed to prevent squash vine borer?
Okay, the magic date in a normal year, so it's not really warm and everything's happening early or really cold, in the southern part of the state, I would say the last week of June.
Okay.
And then usually June in the first week to maybe 2 weeks of July is when the major pressure's coming on. And only one generation a year in a normal year. But, you know, back 3 years ago when we had that crazy 80 degrees in March, we had two generations of squash vine borer. And I saw that in 1988, too, a very warm year. So, you know, weird things can happen when you get very weird weather. But the normal time is the last few days of June in early July. That's when the moths are laying their eggs, and that's when you want to stop them.
Should Lynette in Washington County be overly concerned about a massive colony of box elders?
No. Aside from the nuisance, I noticed yesterday when I was out and about, a little tiny baby box elder bugs, they were clustering all over the side of a building in particular, which is kind of what they do. And it's funny because it doesn't have to be a box elder tree real close by necessarily, because when people see it on their gardens, they freak. But they only feed on the seeds of box elders. In the fall, if they're starting to come in, you can spray them with soapy water or various sprays. That's the time to worry about them coming in the house, but not at this time of the year.
And Bridget on Facebook finally says, to the woman who had problems with horseflies swarming on her hummingbird feeders, she has great success diverting wasps from her feeders by placing a shallow pie pan filled to the rim with an intense sugar water solution. Put it on my porch, but the idea is to have it near but a bit below the hummer feeders. They'll swarm and often drown themselves.
Yeah, probably adding a little bit of soap, too, so that they can't walk on the stuff. It tends to help.
Phil, always a pleasure. We'll see you in a month or so.
Sounds good.
Thank you very much. Phil Pelletieri, UW entomologist, extension entomologist, retired now as director of the UW Insect Diagnostic Lab. But he's still working for us, or with us, I should say. His salary is zero, so it's quite a job. And thank you for listening. Stay with us.